Hey, listeners. Welcome back to Local Global Leaders. I'm your host, Abir Sichter. Today's episode is titled Lead with the Human Story, and I'm thrilled to bring you a conversation with Silas House, a Kentucky Poet Laureate, celebrated novelist, journalist, professor, and activist. Silas shares what it was like growing up in Eastern Kentucky in a working-class family, and how the social divisions he witnessed firsthand shaped both the stories he tells and tie directly into his advocacy work. His reflections really resonate with the broader Appalachian experience, and I think you'll find them as powerful and timely, especially in the fight for representation among marginalized communities. A quick note, this episode was recorded in August of 2025, so you'll hear Silas talk about his then upcoming poetry collection, All These Ghosts, which has been published already. It came out last month in September. And you'll also hear him talk about his new novel, Dead Man Blues. Depending on when you're listening to this episode, if you're hearing this episode right when it dropped, that will be hitting the shelves this week very soon. Or if you're listening to it at a later date, that's probably already out. Either way, go check out those new collections. And before we dive in, I want to give a huge shout out to Josh Bold, one of my producers. Josh handles uploads, created our show logo, and he keeps me updated on all the metrics. We've only ever corresponded over the last year through email, but I finally got to meet him last month when I was randomly visiting the Lexington Writers Room, and I saw him there. So thanks, Josh. It was great to finally meet you in person. And a fun fact, Josh showed me a couch there at the Writers Room that was donated by Silas House himself, and I got to sit on that couch and see and feel all the writing inspiration come to me. All right, let's get into it. Hope you enjoy the episode. Greetings, listeners. I'm here in the studio today with author and activist and journalist Silas House. Silas, thank you so much for joining us today on this episode of Local Global Leaders.
Thanks for having me.
So excited to have you. So excited to have a fellow Eastern Kentuckian, fellow 606. Just really excited to talk with you and to get to hear your story. And with that, my first question I'd like to start out with is your six-word story. How would you describe yourself and your journey in six words?
Well, then I have to count the words, right?
I guess I'd say long time traveling, but still going. I feel like that my life has been two or three acts. I feel like I've lived two or three lives, and they're very different and separate for me. And so the first thing that came to mind for me was an old song, Long Time Traveling. So, yeah.
That's awesome. I like that. It's got a nice poetic flow. You can tell you're a writer. And can you tell us more about your life before you were a published author?
Well, I grew up in a real small town, tight-knit community of about 500 people. I felt like I was kin to just about all of them. My whole family lived on about a one-mile stretch of road for the most part. And so I very much felt like I was being raised by the whole village. You know, it wasn't, I was being raised by aunts and uncles and neighbors and et cetera. I was able to roam freely, so I spent a lot of time outside. I was the only person I knew who was interested in writing or reading, really. But they all really supported that and encouraged it, even if they didn't do it or even if they didn't totally understand it. So I've always felt really fortunate to have grown up in a family and a community that supported me as an artist. Some people don't have that, you know, and that sense of wonder and creativity gets taken from you and erased if you don't have that. I had wonderful teachers, especially a seventh grade teacher who was pivotal. My new book is dedicated to her. My first book of poetry is dedicated to her. And I went straight into college, but I stayed close to home because my mother had cancer at the time. And at the time, we thought it was a death sentence. But here, 30-some years later, you know, she's still living and healthy. But at the time, I turned down a scholarship to a major university that was only about 3 hours away, but that felt so far away. Mm-hmm. And so straight out of college, I knew that I didn't want to go right into teaching because I was already working on a novel. And so I decided I wanted to take a job that I could leave at the workplace and not bring home with me. And so I became a mail carrier. And that turned out to be probably the best thing I ever did for my riding, because on the mail route all day, I was alone. I was driving for several hours, and I could just compose scenes in my head. And when I got home, I was, you know, ready to pour it all out on the page. And so I was able to complete my novel. And after that, you know, I was published, and 6 months later, I quit my job as a mail carrier, and I've been riding ever since.
That's awesome. That's so cool that you're, like, using that experience as a mail carrier. It sounds like that kind of created time for you in a way. Like, you're able to use that time to be creative and to, like, except pour it out at the end of the day.
Yeah. Well, the main thing a rider needs is time to think, time to be quiet and be still in their mind. And being a mail carrier allowed me that. Even though it's a very rigorous job, it allowed me to, you know, find that stillness in my mind. You know, I was driving for long stretches in the country. So there are some parts of rural routes where you go a long way between mailboxes.
It's funny to have a time. I think now, especially when I go back home to Johnson County or across Kentucky, I'm just like, okay, I gotta find the podcast. I listen to a podcast, gotta fill that void. But, you know, I never really think of, oh, I could actually use that time to, like, think.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Often I am listening to podcasts or audiobooks when I'm driving, but there will be long stretches still where I'll just turn everything off and be still and roll the windows down and, you know, just try to think about what I'm working on.
That's cool. And I just found it interesting. You said growing up, you were one of the few, or one of the, you know, the only person you know who wanted to be, who's into, like, you know, wanted to be a writer. Like, what kind of drew you into that at an early age? Do you remember your first inspiration?
Well, I mean, I think I was just born with that in me. So I don't know. It was just part of who I was. I had this innate need to write things down and to read. However, I think that I was given permission by a TV character. When I was growing up, one of the few shows that everybody watched was called The Waltons. And one of the main characters was a young man who wanted to be a writer. He was from Appalachia. He was from a working class family. And nobody else understood his desire to be a writer. And so seeing John Boy Walton, and that name is really familiar to most people of Generation X and before. Seeing him every week on my TV, you know, just sort of validated that desire for me. I was really lucky to grow up in a time when two of the biggest shows on TV were about famous writers. Well, about people who wanted to be writers. Little House on the Prairie and The Waltons. Oh, yeah. You know, and those were the two shows that everybody I knew watched. So strangely enough, you know, I was led to literature, I think, through TV.
That's an interesting path. And I think that's, of course, led you to be a leader here in the community. I mean, a leader in Kentucky, a leader in the literary community, a leader in activism. Like, what motivates you to be a leader in so many spaces?
Well, I think when you're from a disenfranchised place and culture and people, artists often do take on those roles. I think for the most part, a lot of Appalachian people live in congressional districts where their Congress, members of Congress serve corporations more than they serve the people. And so you're sort of put into that role as an artist. You have a public platform, and you have a voice, and people will come to you and say, you know, will you tell this story? Will you help us? And so even if you don't choose it, I think often that responsibility is put on you. And there's just a long history of that in disenfranchised places, cultures, where the artists become the voices in that way.
I think you feel like it's because artists, of course, they can express it, they can communicate it, they can really inspire others, right?
They can articulate it, and also, you know, they have that public platform often to be able to do it. also, when you are, you know, a public person or an artist, sometimes, like, national publications will seek you out on particular issues. Mm. You know, let's say there's a big Appalachian issue. Sometimes the New York Times or the Atlantic or NPR will seek out artists from the specific region that's being affected. And so, therefore, you're given a platform to talk about it. And you feel like, wow, I don't want to waste this opportunity to help my people if I can, you know. And so it's going into becoming a writer, I didn't know that was going to be part of it. You know, I thought I would just be telling stories and writing my books. Mm. I didn't know that when you're from a culture and a place, a region that is looked down upon, negated, belittled, that that responsibility is sort of put on you.
Mm. I can definitely empathize with that growing up in Eastern Kentucky too. Just, yeah, the way, not just the way, it's funny, outside of the state, the way people look down on Kentucky, but then also here in Kentucky, how people in like Louisville, Lexington, for example, or other parts of the state look down on Eastern Kentucky. Right. It's like having to face both those dynamics. And you kind of mentioned, of course, you know, I can tell why you're highlighting Appalachia in your books, but you kind of mentioned like it's important to you to also highlight the socioeconomic struggle or kind of like talk about the working class, right?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that when I'm thinking about social justice work or representation or any of those things, I'm usually thinking of three really specific things that I've experienced myself. One is being Appalachian, one is growing up working class, and one is being LGBTQ. And so having those three distinct identities, I often feel like I have to speak out on some things like that. One of the defining things of my life, though, is definitely being raised lower working class and coming from people who were raised in deep poverty. My foundation is that my parents were so hardworking and instilled the great work ethic in me. They were often telling me stories of their own childhoods and their youth that sometimes made me feel guilty that I had so much more than they had. So it just made me very aware of class. I also, you know, have experienced being treated differently. I come from a very class divided county. Mm-hmm. And so if you weren't wealthy, you were treated very differently. The other layer of that is that I grew up across from a big strip mine. And so that makes you really aware of inequality and the way the poorer people are the ones who have to put up with a lot of the environmental devastation in a way that higher class people don't, you know, and things like that. So it was just a constant. And it was something that my whole family talked a lot about being treated badly because they were poor, and knowing that they were looked down upon because of their status. And they also talked a lot about climbing up out of that poverty. Mm-hmm. So it was a paradox, you know, to be raised around coal mining extraction and see the bad parts of that, but also to know the good parts of that, because I come from a family that was able to rise up out of poverty because of coal. Mm. You know, so I think that gave me a lot of complexity right from the beginning, because I could examine different sides of an issue and not be absolutist. Mm. And that's important for a writer to have that ability.
I like that you're pulling from, I mean, this perspective of thinking about what your parents went through with the difference in generation to what you saw. I mean, yeah, with coal mining back home. I mean, I remember we learned about different types of coal in like first grade. Mm-hmm. It's like how important it is to Eastern Kentucky, but like I said, how important it is to, you know, it has the environmental effects, but it's also important to the economy. I mean, that's what brought my family to Eastern Kentucky. My mom's a pulmonologist, a lung doctor. So with the black lung, the coal mines and the smoking too, like that's what brought our family there.
Yeah, it always amazed me and frustrates me still how much we were taught about the benefits of coal, but I don't ever remember an environmental group being brought in to talk to us. So there's a real imbalance there in Eastern Kentucky schools.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just it's just, I think, ingrained in you from the beginning. Yeah. I mean, our, like I said, not just being taught in first grade, like half our science projects in elementary were about coal. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it sounds like, you know, you've talked about how your life kind of inspired this activism. How does your writing also inform the activism?
Well, I mean, you can't be a writer and not be deeply empathetic. And so I think that leads to activism. If you're not only thinking about the rocks falling on your own house, but you have to think about the rocks that are falling on other people's houses. And I think largely American culture teaches us that charity begins at home, meaning you got to take care of yourself first. Well, I understand that, but I also think that you can't take care of yourself properly if you don't care about other people. And if you don't recognize other people's struggles and realize that injustice is injustice is injustice, or inequity is inequity. So I just think being an artist and being an activist goes hand in hand in that you have to be thinking about those things in a deep way. And a big part of, for me at least, and for most writers I know, is the act of preservation. And so that also goes hand in hand with activism, you know, because you're trying to preserve the environment, or you're trying to preserve people's rights or gain their rights or things like that.
I mean, your work, too, I think it's so informative on these class struggles, on Appalachia, on LGBTQ rights. Do you intend for your writing to inspire others to be leaders or be activists on those issues? Is that like an intention you have?
I mean, that's always a big plus when that happens. I didn't go into writing thinking that, but you know, when you have books in the world and people start to come to your events and say, reading this book helped me to come out, or reading this book taught me more about the injustice going on in my community and it made me get involved, or that's the best things. You know, no award from a, you know, awards committee can equal somebody mm-hmm. coming to your event and saying, this book changed me. So, although I didn't go into it thinking that's what I want to happen, that's definitely been the biggest reward for me as an artist, is to hear from people that it did have some impact on them.
That's, I mean, that sounds really rewarding. And in addition to all those leaders you've inspired and activists, I was curious, what would you say is your own leadership style and philosophy, and how you differentiate that between, you know, your roles as a writer, as a journalist, as a professor, as an activist? Do you like have one constant leadership style or philosophy, or do you have like different views?
Well, I think the main thing is I never want to write a polemic. I never want to make people feel like they're being beaten over the head with an agenda. Mm. I think you must always lead with the human story. And that's what's important. People are going to respond much more to a social issue if they're told a human story and how a human being is affected by that, rather than just being given a bunch of statistics and facts and things like that. So, you know, I wrote a novel called Southernmost that's about a preacher who is having a crisis of conscience because his brother has come out to him. He's rejected him terribly simply because that's what he's been taught to do his whole life. And then when his brother disappears, he does about a decade of self-examination. And after really thinking about this deeply for 10 years, he decides he was wrong and that he should have embraced and accepted his brother instead of rejecting him. And so it, when people read that book, they come away, you know, often thinking a lot about LGBT issues, especially in relation to matters of faith. But at the same time, all that's going on in the background. And what's really happening in the novel is these human beings who are in relationships with each other. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's a lot about the lead character's relationship with his son and how he doesn't want to transfer his own prejudices onto his child and things like that. So it's about relationships and connections and things like that, more than it's about, you know, any kind of political ideas or social issues. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I guess my main answer is you have to lead with emotion. You have to lead with the human story instead of leading with statistics and a fact sheet. Mm-hmm. That's what works for me.
I think that tends to compel people more to really draw them into, yeah. I mean, to the actual story, right?
I think you just have to tell the truth. And people respond to the truth more than anything else. Well, people are of two ways of being, I think. Some people love a lie, and some people love the truth. And I think a lot of people latch on to lies that make them feel good about themselves, whereas other people latch on to the truth that illuminates something about themselves and makes them realize something. And I think when you look at the political landscape right now, it's easy to see who loves a lie and who loves the truth.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a big struggle we're facing politically, we're facing across society. What would you say are the biggest struggles you've encountered in your leadership journey among the, you know, the various roles you play?
Well, I think that we operate in absolutes these days, and people read headlines instead of whole news articles. They listen to sound bites instead of the entire story. Mm-hmm. And so I think the biggest challenge for me is to try to get people to take the long form approach and really learn the details and really learn the facts of a thing instead of latching onto just a soundbite or a headline or some kind of absolutism. I think it's really dangerous the way that we so often divide the world up into monsters and saints. Mm-hmm. And we all know that people aren't like that. I think it's really easy for us to look at people who are supporting and defending legislation that we find reprehensible and just say, oh, they're evil, they're awful, they're monsters. But at the same time, we know that most of those people are not, and that's what makes it really difficult and heartbreaking. If we could accept that those people are just bad, evil people, then we could just easily put them out of our lives, and it would be no problem. The heartache that most of us have is that we are witnessing good people support and defend reprehensible policies. Mm-hmm. So the thing is, we have to examine that complexity, and it's not easy to do, and we got to have conversations, you know, with people that are hard to have. Personally, I think art does that. I think it'd be really hard for me to sit down with a complete and utter homophobe and talk about LGBTQ issues and make some sense in a constructive way. But I can write a whole novel where I'm trying to make the characters as complex as possible. And if somebody will give that a chance, you know, and go into it with an open mind and an open heart, I think that they will see the complexities there too. So it's like a two-way street. You know, those conversations have to happen. And they become harder and harder to happen these days. It's just, you know, the internet has done many great things, but I think the worst thing it has done is make absolutism easier.
And I think, with what you see with these conflicting and, I mean, diverse voices, too, that you see in policy and society, it sounds like you try to bring it into your writing to have, like, you know, a story or characters that emulates that too, right?
Well, yeah, and I think the thing is that if you're writing about human beings, that's going to happen. You know, it's, you know, when I write a novel like Southernmost and it happens to involve LGBTQ issues, most people who are living in this world right now have some experience with that, in that they know somebody who is LGBTQ, they love somebody who is LGBTQ, or they are themselves, and so they can relate to that. So that's just life. However, LGBTQ people have, their existence has been politicized. And so, therefore, if you're writing about those issues now, you are writing about something political. That's disturbing to me. These are people's lives. As a gay person myself, I feel like my existence has been politicized by politicians who use fear to get votes. And they, you know, like to stir up anger and fear among people because it makes them more relevant. So on one hand, I totally understand why people would look at a book that involves the LGBTQ issues and think that it is, you know, political or social issues, things like that. But at the same time, I'm just coming at it from the point of view of these are people's lives that I'm exploring.
And it's so interesting to hear about those, I mean, like I said, the conflicting voices, the struggles you face and the struggles you try to, you know, tell the story of. I was curious, too, in your kind of leadership journey, have you ever experienced, like, toxic leadership from someone or in a position you were in, and how has that influenced you?
I've witnessed all kinds of toxic leadership, and I think it's always rooted in greed. Every time I can think of a leader who is using toxic tactics or malice, it's always because they're concerned about making money every single time. Mm-hmm. It's always about power and money. To me, that's the root of all toxicity that I've witnessed, especially among leaders. I mean, I can't think of a single leader that I have found to be toxic who wasn't just doing it to try to gain power or make money. I think that's what, you know, it's one of the main things. Sorry, I'll rephrase that. I think if we can get through this period of just preserving our democracy, one of the main things we need to focus on is making sure that members of Congress are hemmed in their money making, whether it be in working with lobbyists or the way that they're able to invest with the knowledge they get before other people get and things like that. It's absolutely corrupt, and that is not limited to one party at all. So we really need to restructure the way that members of Congress are allowed to make money.
I think it's a very important cause, and really, it sounds like tying back to your ideas, I mean, of preservation and activism, like we need to hold those leaders accountable to kind of those ideas too, right?
Yeah, we need to have politicians who are actually doing public service, who are there because they want to serve the people, not because they want to make more money. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I hate to be so cynical, but I can think of a handful of politicians that I really believe are there to serve the public and are not there just to get really rich.
Mm-hmm. And with that, you know, thinking about, like, those effective leaders who, you know, you may respect, I kind of have my own leadership philosophy, what I call my 3 M's, being an effective motivator, a competent manager, and a supportive mentor. So, like, motivator, mm-hmm. manager, mentor. How do you see those three roles for you as a leader? Do you see them as, like, three separate things or three things that are all tied together?
Mentor, motivator.
And manager.
Well, first of all, I think it's really important for artists to be mentors to other artists. You have to pass that on. And we're really lucky in Kentucky to have a very vibrant writing community that is generous and that helps each other, and especially finds ways to mentor new talent and things like that. I think among the artists that I know, all of us really want to keep the literature and the artistry of the Commonwealth vibrant, and that involves new talent, you know. And I think being a mentor feeds you as much as it feeds the mentee. You know, it keeps you fresh and it keeps you energized and excited about the work. So it's not as selfless as it sounds. But it's also repaying a debt to your mentors, you know, so it has to keep going. Management, I mean, is incredibly important. Self-management is, for an artist, is incredibly important. I mean, all of us have deadlines as an artist, but to some degree, you have to manage your own work and you have to manage your own time in a big way. And I have always felt like a juggler as a writer because, you know, I have to figure out how much of my day can I devote to observing the world, how much of it can I devote to actually writing, how much of it am I devoting to this event that I have to do to make money to support myself as an artist. How much of it do I devote to promoting the work because it has to, you know, it has to reach people. So you're juggling all these things all the time. Most of us have two or three jobs, you know. What was the third end?
Motivator.
And I guess motivation goes into both of those things because you're trying to motivate other people to consume art and to make art, and you're also trying to keep yourself motivated to manage your own time and all that. So those three M's, that's great. I'd never thought of it that way, but those are all three things that I'm constantly thinking of as an artist.
Awesome. Yeah, I appreciate you sharing that, and I appreciate you answering all those questions about leadership development and your journey. And I'm going to, this next part of the interview, I'm going to ask what I call some local global questions and then some fun questions too. But I want to start out with, I know you've worked with Tyler Childers on his music video, In Your Love. I actually grew up in the same area as Tyler Childers. He went to Paintsville High School and to Johnson Central. I think he and I were in the same room a few times. Never actually met him, but I have friends who are friends of his. But, you know, he's been a great inspiration to Eastern Kentucky as of you. But I was just curious, you know, what inspired you to work with him and to write the story for that music video for In Your Love?
Well, Tyler tells the story that he read my first book in college and that it spoke to him and sort of gave him permission to be an artist himself, you know. And I think all of us who grew up in specific cultures need somebody else from our specific culture to show us that it can be done, that we can go out into the larger world. And he has said, you know, that Clay's Quilt was one of the things that did that for him. And over the process of him saying that, we just got to know each other and became friends and then eventually worked together. And, I mean, it's well known that we worked together on the music video, but we've also done several things together, you know. And I mean, I only work with people like that if I respect them as artists. Mm-hmm. And so I really respected him as a songwriter and a singer. And he's an incredible reader, just a great intellect. And so that made it a no-brainer for me to work with him on a few projects.
You know, getting into musical work and, of course, the work that's taken you all over the world. I wanted to ask how you internalize the idea of sort of like global identity and global citizenship, and how you view like what's happening around the world. How does that affect you as a change maker here in Kentucky? Mm-hmm.
Well, first of all, I think that we are all more alike than we're different, and I'm always reminded of that. And I'm not sure that I totally understood that until my first novel was published. And, you know, it's set in this little bitty town in Eastern Kentucky. It's very specific. There's a lot of vernacular in it, things like that. And then I started getting letters. Like, I remember one letter from a family in India. And this woman was telling me about, you know, how similar Clay's experience was to her own experience growing up in the mountains of India and facing a lot of environmental stuff and just a close-knit family. And that sort of blew my mind in the moment, you know, being from a place where everybody looked the same and sounded the same and had been there for generations, you know, and things like that. And so to find that this could resonate across the world. And so now I teach Appalachian literature at Berea College. And one thing that reveals itself over and over is the Appalachian students really relate to that class because they're finding out that great art comes from where they're from. But then also, there's a great mix at Berea of Appalachian students and international students. And so, but then the international students are really relating to Appalachian literature because they realize how similar that culture is to their own specific cultures. And so I think the thing that's been revealed is that, you know, like I said, we're all more alike than we think we are. I think that we talk a lot about our differences and not as much about our similarities. So I guess the other part of my answer for that would be one of my favorite writers early on was James Steele. He's from Knott County, Kentucky. He wrote one of the foundational books of Appalachian literature. It's called River of Earth, a beautiful novel that everybody should read. He once said, "What happens in Afghanistan happens to me." And I've always loved that quote because it just reminds me that as Americans, we so often separate ourselves from the rest of the world. And I don't know, we might see a refugee crisis. We might see a refugee crisis happening on the other side of the world. And we think, oh, I feel bad about that. I'm sorry about that. I'm sad for those people. But we just move on with our lives and we don't really, it doesn't really have a great impact on us, I don't think. I think we often think, oh, that's happening to them and mm-hmm. we're lucky to be Americans or something like that. And we move on instead of really acting. But the thing is that all those things could so easily happen to us and the tables can so easily turn. And so I wrote a novel called Lark Ascendant, and one thing I wanted to do in that book was put Americans in refugee boats and sort of put Americans into the shoes of refugees and make us think about how easily all that those things could happen to us. I mean, climate change is one thing that's going to lead to, you know, a lot of changes in North America, and the results of that are going to lead to a lot of climate refugees and things like that. And so I guess I'm just always trying to put myself in the shoes of other people and think about their experiences and how easily that could be my own experience. And I guess, you know, if I could, any time that I'm working with a writer, the main thing I'm trying to get them to do is just to be more empathetic, because you cannot create characters, you cannot deliver stories without stepping into the shoes of others. So to me, it's like there's a saying in creative writing that the more specific you are, the more universal you are. And so I think that's what I'm trying to say, is that the global and the local are, they have to go hand in hand. They are not separate things. One of my favorite poems is called The Briar Sermon. It's by Jim Wayne Miller. And in it, he's sort of holding Appalachian people to task and working class people and saying, you know, you have to be proud of your identity. You have to hold on to who you are and not lose that part of yourself. And one thing that he says is, you don't have to think ridge to ridge. You can think ocean to ocean. And so to me, he's saying, you don't have to just be local. You can also be global. And you can realize that those things, you know, should work together and not against each other.
That's interesting. It's I loved hearing that story too about that family in India who, like, you know, told you about how the story you're writing here about Appalachia relates to them growing up. I was curious what advice you have for people who are, whether they want to be leaders or change makers, who hope to put Kentucky on the global map and show the world, you know, what Kentucky offers to the globe.
Well, you know, when I'm traveling, often I'm asked about what gives me hope and what gives me despair as a Kentuckian and in relation to Kentucky. And I think the main thing that always comes to mind for me is there's so much great grassroots work that happens here. And that goes back to when you're from a place where you feel like your representative isn't really representing you properly, yet they keep getting put in office somehow. And so you just finally are like, I got to do this work myself. And so you get involved in grassroots work, whether that be protecting the environment or working for some kind of social change or feeding people or helping people who've survived natural disasters or whatever. I think that I just see a lot of people doing the good work quietly, not asking for any attention, but just getting the work done.
And what are key leadership lessons you've learned from books you've read?
I think one of the key leadership things I've learned from reading is that you use what you have. You do what you can. I think sometimes people feel powerless because they don't know how they can contribute. I mean, not everybody can be out marching in the streets, but you can. If you can't be out marching in the streets, maybe you can be calling your legislator and voicing your opinion. If you can't be marching out in the streets, you can still hear somebody tell a racist joke and speak up and say, hey, that's not cool. I mean, I just think there are lots of small ways to chip away at these systems of oppression. And you just have to use what you have, do what you can. A really foundational book for me is The Color Purple by Alice Walker. And one thing I love about that book is that the lead character, Celie, her greatest desire is to learn. And I think the smartest people I know are not necessarily the smartest people because of the brain they were born with, but more because of the desire to learn that they have. The more you want to learn, the more you seek out knowledge, the smarter you will become, you know? And Celie is definitely doing that throughout The Color Purple. And one thing that The Color Purple teaches us is that you have to do that, yeah, with quote-unquote book smarts, but you also have to do it with emotions. How do you become more emotionally intelligent as well as more well-read and, you know, gaining more facts and things like better critical thinking skills and all that, but you also have to learn how to love better. Yeah, I think that's, a lot of books have taught me that.
And what are, you mentioned The Walton Show earlier. I was curious, what are leadership lessons you've learned from, I mean, other TV shows or from movies or from, like, pop culture?
I mean, when I think about pop culture that has been really effective to me, it's been a lot about how to be a better person. I was raised in a evangelical fundamentalist sect. We went to church 3 or 4 times a week, 3 or 4 hours every time, and it was just constant. But what I was constantly being taught was to judge others and to put my own beliefs onto others. And I remember very little about being of service to others and loving others. And, I, you know, once I left that sect and got out of that, did my own journey of, you know, figuring out what I believed in and eventually, you know, settling on a different congregation. I chose one that centered on service to others, and loving others instead of judgment and forcing my beliefs onto others. And so, sorry, let me try to succinctly answer this. Well, I think the major lesson that I've taken from pop culture that has really stuck with me is to how to be good, being good to others. I was raised in a really evangelical fundamentalist sect that didn't talk a lot about being good to others so much as it talked about judging others. And it was really through the secular that I learned how to be a better person. I don't know why this film always comes to mind. There's a scene in Fried Green Tomatoes, a movie, you know, that a lot of people love, but sort of one of the main characters is sort of ostracized by the rest of the town because the way she dresses and she acts like a man, you know, and things like that. So she's sort of seen as the other, but she secretly goes out at night and gets food to people who are hungry during the Depression, people who have lost their homes and things like that. And she robs it from a rich company and takes their food from a train. She's sort of a Robin Hood character, you know, in that way. But I just remember watching that as a young person, being so deeply moved by that and thinking, you know, that's the good work. It's just, you know, if you can help other people, it's not about changing them into who you want them to be. And I learned, you know, from books like The Color Purple and To Kill a Mockingbird and the books of Willa Cather and Thomas Hardy and Ferris Bueller's Day Off, you know, is a foundational film for me because it's about living life to its fullest. And so it covers one day where he's just living as fully as he can. That's a great lesson to learn. It's profound, you know. So there are just lots of films like that. Music has been a big part of that for me too. You know, I call all those things the secular holy, meaning they're all secular works that have taught me more about how to be a better person. And when you're raised in a sect the way I was, as a child, I was taught that just about every part of my humanity was bad. Like any kind of desire was bad. The desire to dance, the desire to be a sexual person, the desire to leave your place, go somewhere else. Just all of that, you were taught that everything you should feel guilty about, just about anything that made you feel good. And so coming out of that, there's a long process of figuring out how can I be a good person and also be a part of the world. And then you realize there's so much in the world that is good, you know, and you shouldn't be afraid of it all. But that's a long process when you're raised in a real fundamentalist sect the way I was. Mm-hmm.
I think that I can really resonate with that journey. The faith I grew up in similarly, like, you know, was very, very much about like judging people and looking at them, looking down at them. But that inspired me to kind of go the other way. So I really appreciate hearing that. And hearing about, that I like that phrase, the secular holy. Like, we look down on these pop culture sources a lot. And, you know, there's negatives there, too. But there are lessons to learn. Yeah. I really like that phrase.
Right. I mean, a good example of that is, like, The Exorcist, for instance. It's one of the most famous horror movies ever. You know, it's famously profane. You have this child who's talking in really coarse language. It's gross. You know, there's lots of vomit and stuff like that. There is some real vulgar moments in it, you know, really sexual moments. But ultimately, it's a film about faith. And it's about when your faith is challenged, it becomes stronger and things like that. You know, so I think that's a good example of something that can be looked down upon as a piece of vulgarity or coarseness, that is actually a really profound lesson in belief. Yeah.
And I was curious to know, who would you say are your main, like, leadership role models, who you see as, like, exemplary leaders, whether fictional or real characters? You mentioned Ferris Bueller already. Mm-hmm. I don't know if he would be one, but who are those role models you look up to as leaders?
Well, this is a recent one, but I have to say Governor Andy Beshear has taught me a lot about how to operate in a world. I mean, I encounter a lot of bigotry online, and I've always tried to react to that as diplomatically as I can. But a few times I've lost my patience and just given it back to people. And to see the way that he reacts to that has been a real lesson for me, and how to give people grace but also not be a doormat. Mm. I think he's a wonderful role model in how to be compassionate but also not weak. Mm-hmm. So he's been a great example, I think, for a lot of us. And he leads with his faith, you know? When people criticize him for his stance on LGBTQ people or race or whatever, his response is usually, "My faith teaches me," etc. And so I think I really admire the way he has done that. One of my role models is Sinead O'Connor. She became really famous when I was about 17 or 18, I guess. And she said a lot of controversial things when she was a young artist that she received a lot of heat for, and she was right about every one of them. I mean, probably the most famously, she tore up a picture of the Pope on live TV, and, you know, she was banned all over the place. People burned her albums, and she was, you know, totally vilified for that. But she was speaking out on the way that the Catholic Church had turned a blind eye to a lot of, well, I mean, frankly, molestation and things like that, child abuse in the church. She was drawing attention to that long before it was revealed that that was happening in a real systemic way. I just, you know, she was so brave and ferocious, and so she, and unapologetic, but also it was all rooted in love. None of it was rooted in malice, and so that taught me a great lesson. So she's one of my activist role models for sure. And then there are people closer to home, like Helen Lewis was an Appalachian woman she's an academic, but she was also an activist who was out on the front lines, on picket lines, and standing with people, you know, standing with her community. Or people like Judy Bonds, who was a waitress at Pizza Hut, and then she witnessed this enormous fish kill in her creek. And so she began to force public health officials to examine why all these fish were killed in the creek. Hmm. And it turned out, you know, that the local coal company was using the heavily carcinogenic chemicals that were killing the aquatic life, which, of course, was leading to cancer rates spiking in the community. And so she brought awareness to that. She ended up dying of brain cancer herself, you know, living on that creek. And until her dying breath, she was fighting back. And so there's just lots of people like that, you know, really incredibly famous people like Sinead O'Connor, and then people who live up in a holler who refuse to be silenced, who have been inspirational to me.
That's awesome. I like the heroes you mentioned, just, I mean, the diverse backgrounds they have. That's really awesome. I definitely have to look into more some of them. I mean, of course, I know Sinead O'Connor's story and Governor Beshear, mm-hmm. also inspirational to a lot of Kentuckians. So, but
one more I'll mention is Bell Hooks, who I was really lucky to be friends with. Every time I was with her, I was always totally conscious of being in the presence of a genius. And I think she's the only true genius that I've ever been, you know, in their company for extended periods of time. And just to witness the way that she thought about the world and how complexly she thought about things was inspirational to me. She just thought so deeply. And she once told me that she cried every day. And I witnessed her doing that. And it was because she just felt things so deeply and she cared so deeply. And she had sort of an aggressive exterior. Mm-hmm. Because her interior was so soft that the exterior had to be more brusque, you know? So a lot of people misunderstood that about her and found her to be too brusque, but it was because she was so soft inside. And so that taught me a lot about how to strike that balance of being soft, but also protecting yourself and all those things. Yeah, a great inspiration.
Yeah, those are all amazing figures. And I think what you're saying there about bell hooks kind of ties back into what you were saying about Governor Bashir, about mm-hmm. like being, you know, trying to be a soft, understanding person, but also like, you know, connecting with people and being yourself. So
I think the thing that the word I go back to time and time again when I think about leadership is balance, striking that balance, you know, of retaining that empathy, but also protecting yourself and others, and never being a doormat, mm-hmm. but also never being a barbed wire. Yeah.
What would you say among all the publications you've written, which one's your favorite, your personal favorite of your own work?
Well, it's always hard. It's kind of like choosing between your children. You know, you're afraid you'll hurt their feelings. It's usually the most recent book that I worked on. But I would have to say the book that I'm most proud of and I feel like did what I wanted it to do, that I feel has reached the most people in the way that I wanted it to, is Southernmost. And I'm mainly basing that on just the way people have reacted to me personally and mm-hmm. talked to me and told me stories about the way the book spoke to them. Ultimately, that has nothing to do with me. I think that people find the piece of art they need for the moment that they're in. But I'm really proud that I was able to write a book that did that for some people. And it, you know, it's not anything about like my talent or anything like that. It's just about that my experience resonated with a lot of other people's experience. And so that's a great thing when that happens.
That's awesome. And do you also have a favorite character you've written?
Well, I mean, a lot of people love my character, Clay Sizemore. He's the lead in my first book. And I think the reason that they like him is he's just like this good old country boy. I mean, he's as hardcore country boy as you can find, but he's so sensitive and aware of the natural world. And he's just like a lot of boys that I grew up with, young men that I grew up with. I think that people think of Appalachian men and they just think they're old rednecks, you know? But most of the Appalachian men that I know are deeply sensitive and quiet and introspective and all those things. But we mostly see the stereotype of the violent, you know. And when I say the word redneck, I'm meaning it in the stereotypical way, not the historic way, because the historic way has a good connotation, right? Like a redneck is somebody usually that was either involved with the labor movement, fighting back against government and corporations, or a redneck somebody that worked out in the fields or, you know, whatever. But it now has that negative connotation. Anyway, I think people really love Clay, and so that makes me love him. And I really love the lead character in Lark Ascending. His name is Lark. I really like him because I wanted to write an action story, an action adventure story starring a gay character. That book actually stars a gay character and a middle-aged woman. And you never see those two kinds of people starring in an action film. So I wanted to write a book that could be an action film that starred those two kinds of people. Yeah.
That's an awesome dynamic. Can you tell us about your plans for your next book?
Well, I have three books coming out in the next year. Wow. So it's a busy time. Actually, I have four books coming out in the next year and a half.
Oh, wow.
So I have a book of poetry coming out. It's my first collection of poetry. It's kind of a memoir written in poems. I have a murder mystery coming out. I've always loved mysteries. They've been sort of my comfort reading. So it's a little more commercial, a little more like a beach read.
Mm-hmm.
But we need some escapism right now. The next, fall of 26, I have a sort of more epic scope novel that's centers on a gay couple and an interracial couple from 1918 to 1976. So it spans just about most of the 20th century and just looks at these two couples who everything, you know, they have all these obstacles against them and being together. And then in the spring of 27, I have a picture book coming out about my beagle. A lot going on.
It's a lot of amazing work and a lot of different, very different types of work. I'm looking forward to checking out all those. I got two dogs myself, so I'm sure they'll be big fans reading your picture book, as will I. And I'm a big Sherlock Holmes fan, read all the Sherlock Holmes stories, so I'm interested to see your first take on a mystery novel. That'll be awesome.
Yeah. I hope you'll look for it.
For sure. One question that's, you know, debated all over the world. I've been told so many different things about it and have one of the most prolific writers here, so I really want to, get an answer on this. What are your views on the serial or Oxford comma?
I cannot not use the Oxford comma. I do a lot of journalism, mm-hmm. and, you know, the Oxford comma is just not used in journalism. I put it in anyway, and I let the editor take it out because I need to use it. It's ingrained in me, and it just doesn't make sense to me not to use it. Too many sentences don't make sense if you don't use the Oxford comma. And so I'm a big supporter of the Oxford comma.
Yes, so I'm really excited to hear that. So am I. I've written a lot of policy work, and it's just funny, like, how we're told not to use it. It was actually, I used to work on a project funded by the federal government, and under it actually changed when the president changed. Mm-hmm. Our writing on the Oxford comma changed. Mm. And I was like, oh, that's like an administration change.
Right. It's
like, I didn't know that's how it works. Yeah. But and it was when we weren't allowed to use it. Yeah, like you just said, to create so much confusion.
Yeah, I do not understand people's aversion to it.
Yeah. maybe that will be your next activist space to fight for that.
Right, yeah.
My last question, you know, we started this interview with your 6-word story. Now I'd like to hear, what would you say is your 6-word legacy? That are 6 words you want people to envision when they think about you and your legacy for Kentucky and for the world.
He loved books, people, and nature. Is that 6 words?
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
That's the first thing that comes to mind. Yeah.
That's awesome. I like it. Those are 3 amazing things to center your life on and be remembered for sure.
Yeah.
But Silas House, thank you so much for taking the time for this interview. It's such a great honor to meet you and to hear your story and to hear about your work. It's been so inspirational. We just really appreciate having you on.
Thank you for these great questions. You've given me a lot to think about. Thanks.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That wraps up my conversation with Silas House. His reflections on the artist's role as both a storyteller and an activist, and the power of using a public platform to confront both truths and falsehoods, especially in today's divisive climate, really highlight his passion and his purpose as a writer and an advocate, and as a voice for the oppressed. My next episode drops in November, and it will feature Angie Cruz-Tinch, Executive Director of Special Olympics Kentucky. Until then, remember to live local and think global, fellow changemakers.